Okay. Thank you, Peter. Am I on? Yeah. Okay, good afternoon. What I'd like to do today is talk to you about some of the work that's going on at the Deep Underground Lab in Sudbury, the Snow Lab. And what I thought I'd do is give you a thread about why do you want to go underground in the first place. It's not a particularly easy place to do your experiments. So what is the justification for doing that? So I selected one of the research streams that we're involved in at Snow Lab, and that's the Dark Matter Program. That's actually my background before I came over to Canada. But what I'll do is I'll take you through the question about what is dark matter and how one goes about detecting it. And as part of that, come to the question about why you would want to go underground and build a laboratory and do your experiments deep underground. Just give you a very brief update about some of the progress in underground labs around the world. It's a burgeoning field at the moment. There's a lot of changes going on, new labs opening, older labs being developed, and then spend most of the talk giving you, it's not just going to be a slideshow, but primarily a slideshow about Snow Lab, where we are at the moment with the facility and some of the projects. So what you see on the backdrop here is that this is a group of students in 2 kilometres underground, just looking at one of the experimental areas that we have at Snow Lab. So if I come to the question of dark matter, what is dark matter? How do we know that it exists? Well, if we're doing an experiment in Sudbury, we're obviously doing an experiment in the Earth in our own galaxy. So one of the primary questions we have to ask is, what is dark matter in our own galaxy? And still one of the best ways to illustrate this is by looking at rotation curves of galaxies. So if you choose a galaxy like our own, a spiral galaxy, and imagine that this galaxy is rotating in this sense, then the stars on this limb of the galaxy are coming towards you, the stars on this limb are going away from you. You can use the Doppler shift of light, so you select a certain wavelength of light from one of the emission lines from the star. You look at the Doppler shift of that light, and you can work out how fast the star is going. And from that, you can work out the rotational velocity of the galaxy. And what's shown on these diagrams, this is radius in kiloparsecs, so 10 kiloparsecs, 30,000 light years, as a function of the velocity. Now, if everything that was contained within the galaxy was just shown in this picture, i.e. the visible material, the visible mass, then what you would expect to see just from Newtonian dynamics is that the velocity would fall off as a function of distance from the massive center of the galaxy. When you do the measurements and you see what you have as you go outside from the center of the galaxy as a function of radius, you actually find that you have a family of curves which are generally flat. So the velocity is sustained all the way out to the edge of the galaxy. And this is the edge of the galaxy. That's not where you get bored making measurements. That's the end point of the stars. So another way to think about this is that the stars on the extreme end of the galaxy are rotating around so fast that if there wasn't more material holding them in place, they would just fly apart. So the galaxy would disintegrate. This is obviously a galaxy not our own. If you do the same sort of measurements for our own galaxy, for the areas that you can see, you get a very similar picture. So this is our position in terms of the position within our own Milky Way. And you see that you have this relatively flat rotation curve going out. So if you invert that question and say, okay, these things are moving too fast, there's got to be more material holding them in place, you come up with a figure that somewhere between 60 to 90% of the mass of galaxies is in a form that we don't know what it is. It's a non-luminous type of material. There are obvious things that you can look for in terms of stars that haven't ignited or stars that are dead or planets. And people have done searches for those but found that that constitutes at most 15% of the mass of our galaxy, dark matter halo. So there's a significant component of material that we don't understand what it is. If you extend this to larger scale and you look at weighing a galactic cluster, so this is a photograph from Hubble showing every light point in here is a galaxy. You can pick up on the edges here, there are blue arcs of light. And this is an image of a galaxy that exists behind the galactic cluster. And through gravitational lensing, through the fact that mass and space interact and you can bend light if you have a massive material there, you end up with an arc. Now, if it was a perfect lens, you would get an Einstein lens. You can just about make out there on that particular one. This is a micro lens event. You can see a ring there. And again, if you look at the image and you say, okay, what sort of mass profile would I need to be able to get the image as I see it there? That's shown on the bottom thing here. If you have a big enough computer, you can work backwards and work out what the mass profile needs to be across this image to be able to bend light sufficiently, once you know where that blue galaxy is, to bend light sufficiently to get those arcs of light. And that's shown here, so that the spikes are actually indicative of where the galaxies are. But you see that there's a general overall background of material that you can't see in the image, but you know it's there from the gravitational effect. And that's, if you do the calculation again, you're coming up with about 90% of the mass of that galactic cluster is in some invisible dark form. So one of the clear questions is, well, do we understand gravity sufficiently well in these cases? We're using gravity as the probe both in this image and in the previous one where you're measuring the rotation curves. And there's recent results a year ago showing an interacting cluster. This is the Bullitt cluster, where there are two sets of observations have been done, one using X-ray and one using gravitational lensing. And the difference there is that the X-rays will pick up where the material is, where the hot gas is, and the gravitational lensing will pick up where the bulk of the matter is, where the bulk of the material is. And what you see here is the blue indicates where the gravitational effect is, and the red indicates where the X-rays are. These galaxies have interacted. They've actually passed through each other. So this galaxy cluster here has come from this side, passed through this galaxy cluster, and what's happened is that the strongly interacting material has basically been retarded as it moves through. So the dark matter, which is weakly interacting, doesn't self-interact particularly well. That just streams straight through, whereas the normal baryonic material is getting held back. And you get a separation here between where you can see the mass in terms of the gravitational attraction and in terms of the X-ray emission. So this shows you that there is a separation. Now, if the reason that we were inferring dark matter in these sort of images was because we didn't understand gravity, we would expect these two colors to overlap in that image because the gravitational effect would be where the material was. But because there's that separation, this to me is very strong evidence that we have a class of material that we don't understand what it is. It's in some non-baryonic form. If we go to a larger scale and look at the mass of the universe, the total mass of the universe is measured in terms of some cosmological mass density, omega m. I'm not going to go into detail, but it's just built up from various different components, so cold dark matter, hot dark matter, baryonic material, things like the curvature and the dark energy. And the total density, the total mass density that we expect from Big Bang nuclear synthesis is exactly one. And recent observations are confirming that. So this is a combination of observations using cosmic microwave background, large-scale searches, the Big Bang nuclear synthesis models, and so on.
And
it's a ratio. It's a ratio to the critical mass. So one is what we want. So it's basically scaled. The energy density, dark energy, turns out to be about 70%. Of the energy budget of the universe, with the matter density being about 27%. But of that, only 4% is in the form of baryonic material, in the form of normal material. So there's this missing 23%, which is the dark matter on the universal scale. We now know, thanks in part to Snow, that the neutrinos have a mass. But again, if you work through the numbers, you find that it's a very small component of the mass of the universe, and it doesn't add up to the difference between the matter density and the baryonic side. So there's a component of non-baryonic cold dark matter of over about 20% of the mass of the universe. One of the outcomes of this is that there's been great strides in cosmology over the last 10, 15, 20 years to allow them to come to this concordance model. And the concordance model basically is that we don't know what 95% of the universe is made up from. So that's a little irritating. this is where the particle physicists get interested. In particle physics, there are there's a very well-validated standard model of particle physics. So this is the quark model, where you have quarks and leptons that go to build up the family of subatomic particles. And this has been extremely well-validated, but there are problems with it. And some of the problems, for instance, is one of the questions is why the weak force and the gravitational force aren't the same scale, which is known as the hierarchy problem. And there are extensions to the standard model called supersymmetric models, SUSY models, which solve this problem by introducing another group of particles which have some supersymmetry with the existing ones that we're aware of. So, for instance, here you have the well-known Higgs particle. There will be a supersymmetric partner called the Higgs-Eno. So for each of the particles in the standard model, there is an equivalent supersymmetric one. The supersymmetric models have various parameters that go in. I'm not going to go into any detail on these, but it's just to show you that there are a group of parameters that you can test in terms of the accelerators that we have at the moment and get limits to these parameters, which then allow you to feed those back into the supersymmetric models. The point here is that the supersymmetric particles would have been created in the early universe in prodigious numbers. And when the temperature is very hot, they would have been in thermal equilibrium. As the universe cools, the production stalls. And then as it cools further, if you have a situation where the expansion of the universe is basically outruns the annihilation of these particles, you get a freeze out of these different particles. And that's sort of shown here. So this is in terms of time and the number density of the supersymmetric particles. As the universe evolves, depending on the parameters of the particle, it will freeze out at certain points, and you end up with a certain number density. Now, the interesting thing here is that if you feed the weak force in as one of your drivers in these models, you end up with exactly the right number of particles being created in the Big Bang and with us now, as we see in the astrophysical, in the cosmological measurements. So there's a really there's a great coincidence, which for many of us is too much of a coincidence to show. This really is an interesting connection between the cosmology, where we have to have some non-baryonic material, and the new particle physics models, such as supersymmetry, where those particles fall out naturally. So the dark matter in this model is called a WIMP, a weakly interacting massive particle. And the neutralino, which is the lightest supersymmetric particle, is just one of those solutions. So that's one of the strong justifications for looking for these particles in the wild, so that we believe that there is obviously some material out there that we don't understand. The particle physics, the new theories from particle physics, give us a perfect candidate to look for. So as an experimental issue, ask the question, well, where do I actually need to look? And so what's more relevant is if you take those parameters for the supersymmetric particles and you feed them into the theory, you can get a handle on the interaction with normal matter. And that's shown on this plot here. This is rather a busy plot, but it shows the mass of the WIMP in GeV. So 1, 10, 100, 1,000 GeV against a cross-section. And this is it's normalized to a single nucleon, but it's in terms of per square centimeter. The different lines are current experimental results. These are actually 90% upper limits. So if the WIMP particle had a cross-section higher, then we would have expected to have seen it in the experiments conducted so far. The green and the blue blob are the most likely region from supersymmetry where we might find something. So the current supersymmetric models, you feed in the limits that you have from the accelerators that exist, the other observations people have done, you feed in the cosmological parameters, and you get a most likely region which is now beginning to be explored by these experiments. So this shows you the sort of state of the art of the dark matter searches at the moment in one of the channels called spin independent against where we're trying to look. So in terms of dark matter, the experimental challenge, so that's the experimental objective, is to try and build more and more sensitive experiments to push down the cross-section that you can see. The experimental challenge is that the WIMP rate is very low. It's of order, it's now between about 0.1 to 10 to the minus 5 events per kilogram per day. It's a very small energy deposition, tens of keV actual energy, and then because of processes in the detector, nuclear processes in the detector, you actually see less energy coming out generally. Technically, it has a very, because it's just a kinematic recoil, what you're actually looking for is basically the WIMP hitting a nucleus in your detector. The nucleus recoils, and you look at that energy. You're picking up that energy. So it's a kinematic process. And that has a similar exponential background, similar exponential spectrum, energy spectrum, as many of the backgrounds that you worry about. So these are the three inputs. And what that means is the detection technique needs to be very low background, very low radiological background. Of course, that comes from either the gammas and betas from things like uranium and thorium, from the radio impurities all around us, neutrons from the radio impurities as well through, for instance, alpha-N reactions or fission, and cosmic ray muon spallation. Your detector needs to be a low threshold detector and then preferably be able to discriminate. The key thing in terms of the underground physics is this low background statement and ultimately large mass. You're going to need to build ton-scale detectors, active ton-scale or more kiloton-scale detectors in some of these experiments. So in terms of why you want to go underground, it's that question about the getting rid of the background. So any search for rare events, so you're talking either proton decay, double beta decay, all dark matter measurements that I've described in terms of low cross-section measurements, you require very radio-quiet environments to undertake the search. And one of the things that we really worry about in the dark matter field is neutrons, because neutrons are neutral. They will mimic a WIMP. It will go in, hit your nucleus, and give you a similar event as you would see from a dark matter particle. And neutrons come from many sources, but the cosmic ray ones are particularly worrying because they're high energy. So what's shown here is the canonical cosmic ray spectrum. It's a bit small, but this is the energy scale going from 10 to the 11 EV up to 10 to the 21 EV, and showing the 18 orders of magnitude in that energy scale. So these cosmic rays hit the top of the atmosphere, generate extensive air showers, generate muons. So to give you a marker, there's 3 muons a second going through your head at the moment. Two muons a second going through your head at the moment. These muons spallate neutrons from material around us, and that's what gives rise to the particularly troublesome neutron background. So if you go deep underground, you're basically shielding your detectors from these cosmic ray muons, and that gives you a commensurate reduction in the flux and any of the induced byproducts. So the muon background is shown as a function of depth here. So on this curve, we have several underground laboratories picked out. Sudbury, the Snow Lab Observatory, so it's in Sudbury in Northern Ontario. 2 kilometres underground, so it's actually 2,070 metres depth. And that gives you a cosmic ray reduction, a muon reduction of order 10 to the 7 to 10 to the 8. So that reduces the 2 per second going through your head to about 1/4 per square meter per day. So that's a significant reduction. And that's what allows us to remove that neutron background to a point where we can start to measure things. What I wanted to do, though, was also point out that it's not just depth that's important in underground labs, because these are low background experiments that you're taking. So it's the overall particle flux that you're looking for. So you have neutron production from the cosmic ray muon spallation, uranium thorium fission, and the alpha-N reactions from uranium and thorium, for instance. So the going deep gets rid of one of those, gets rid of the cosmic ray muon spectrum. But you also get, this hasn't come out particularly well, this is showing the neutron spectrum for two labs. This is Modan, and this is for the Balby mine. One is a rock salt mine, so in sodium chloride. The other is a hard rock mine and in granite. And the scales are the same. So the point is that what you can pick up is that you actually have fairly consistent neutron fluxes, even though one of them is significantly deeper than the other. And that's to do with the uranium and thorium contamination in the rock. So the spectrum in the lab, in your detectors, depends both on the rock, on the local geology as well as the depth. And again, this is a comparison between a couple of labs. So in blue is Gran Sasso in the Italian Alps. In red is the Modan lab on the French-Italian border. And you can see that the this is neutron energy in MeV. And you can see that the fast neutrons are fairly comparable, but the thermal neutrons are actually significantly less. And that's because there's quite a small contamination of water, which gives you absorption of the thermal neutrons. So the spectrum in the lab, going deep is absolutely required, but it also depends on the local geology. Similarly, with the gamma background, the reduction is in two ways. So the high energy gammas, i.e. the cosmic ray gammas, so anything above 3 MeV or whatever is a cosmic ray initiated gamma. This is the spectrum shown on the surface, and for two labs you see significant reduction. This is important for nuclear astrophysics. So in nuclear astrophysics, people are interested in the cross-sections of the very low cross-sections of some of the more esoteric processes that go on in the stellar interior. And these cross-sections mean that you have to run the measurements for months. The only place you can do that is deep underground, because you can knock down the gamma flux sufficiently that you can begin to pick up the gammas from the reaction that you're looking for. So getting rid of this high-energy gamma, high-energy cosmic ray gamma component is extremely important for the underground community as well. And then below 3.5 MeV, again, it's dependent on the material around you, primarily the amount of uranium and thorium. So the red shows the reduction in a potash mine compared to hard rock mines. The whole point of this is to get the background down. And I'm not going to go through in any detail these slides, but what this shows is that people have done a lot of work. Going underground is the first step. You then have to shield your detectors against the background radiations from the walls, from the rock around you, from people. You then have to think about what is my detector made of, and there's a lot of work going on now in terms of getting very high purity material. So people are electroforming copper underground to build their detectors so that it's very pure. They never bring it up. As soon as you bring it up, you start getting cosmogenic activation of the copper. People are taking lead from Roman galleons that have been sunk under the Mediterranean for 2,000 years. That's to get rid of the lead-210. There's a variety of... the archaeologists love that one. There's a variety of techniques that are being applied to try and make sure that you have an incredibly low background in your detector. And the idea of this slide was just to show you the efforts that people have gone to understand that from a simulation approach. So these are all GEOM-4 simulations using the high-energy physics technology pushed down to lower energies, where you can suppress background radiations from cosmic rays just by going deep. You've got the gammas and betas by running large water shielding systems. Radon, you've got to run in a clean room to get rid of that. The uranium and thorium in the rock, again, you shield or veto against that. Cosmogenics, you go for an underground fabrication. That all allows you eventually to get to the point where you have a low neutron background, a low gamma background, or are very deep. And this shows the science questions that you can attack in an underground lab. So dark matter searches is just one of the core science problems that we're attacking. So what's the physics beyond the standard model? What constitutes most of the mass of the universe? But there is a raft of other science that can be done, ranging from the solar neutrinos that Snow was involved in, double beta decay neutrinos that Snow Plus will be involved in, nuclear astrophysics I've touched on. People can also look at neutrinos from the terrestrial core, from the core of the Earth, see where basically where there's a reactor going on there, where there are reactions at depth, all the way to geophysics, geology, geophysics, and extreme biospheres. So how can material exist at depth, for instance? How can life exist? So that's the justification for going deep. That's why you want to go deep, basically have a low background environment, or have access in the biology case, have access to areas that people haven't studied before. So there are many underground labs that exist around the world. Europe, there's primarily road tunnels through mountains. a couple of mines also being used. Asia, Japan has a mine that is being used. Korea and China are developing labs in hydroelectric plants. North America is actually focused primarily on mines, on vertical access mines. Fundamentally, if there's a deep hole, if there's a deep enough hole, you'll find a physicist in it doing something. There is expansion underway at many of these sites, and I've just picked up a few highlights to give you a feel for the sort of efforts that are going on worldwide. And I'll say different scale experiments are being developed in some of these, from megaton scale in some of the US, in one of the US programs, to kiloton in, for instance, Snow Lab. So in France, on the French-Italian border, there's a tunnel going through the Alps. This is a single tunnel at the moment. There is an excavation underway because of a fire that they had that caused quite a lot of damage. There's an excavation underway to create a safety gallery. And as part of that excavation, they are looking to attract funding to develop a large 40,000 cubic meter lab, which would primarily be targeted at dark matter or double beta decay research. In Japan, people will be aware of the Super Kamiokande detector, which is part of the T2K beamline. There is a new cavern has been excavated to take a dark matter experiment, Xmas, and candles. And this shows you the current situation there is that Xmas is 800 kilograms of liquid xenon. So there's a whole raft of material that needs to go with the experiment in terms of making sure that the xenon is pure enough to be able to see the dark matter interactions. This is a water tank being used as the shielding against the background in the rock. A new player coming onto the scene is a Chinese lab, and there's a hydroelectric plant being developed where this river runs around. I can't remember how many kilometers it is. It runs around, but there's a 200-meter drop between both sides of this mountain. And so they're putting a tunnel through here for a hydroelectric plant and using the gravitational difference, of course, to drive the power. In the middle, there is a lab that is being excavated and converted. So the current status of that lab is that they've built one of the hallways and are beginning, so this is the excavation, and they're beginning to put some experiments into it. Hall A, Hall B is also now almost completely constructed with the potential for a larger hall. The intent is going to be that this will house an array of germanium detectors, which will ultimately also be involved in dark matter searches. So germanium detectors are used ubiquitously in our field for low background measurement. So you're trying to pick up the gammas in a shielded environment to make sure that your material is clean enough before you incorporate it into a detector. I think all of the underground labs have them running. The French have probably the largest. They have an array of six, which has a variety of uses, including aging wine, where they're looking at the age of wine bottles by the amount of things like cesium that you have in it from radioactive fallout. As an aside, they did a series of tests at when the millennium changed, and bottles of wine were being sold for astronomical sums because they were meant to be 100 years old. They find out most of them were actually made in the 1970s because it was after bomb testing. Right, yes, back to the fun stuff. So the US are in the process. They have a couple of labs at the moment, but they're both fairly shallow. One is in northern Minnesota, so north of us, and the other is in a nuclear waste isolation plant in New Mexico. They're developing plans for a very large-scale underground lab in an old gold mine in South Dakota called the Homestake Mine. This was basically decommissioned by the mine company about 5-10 years ago, and they're looking at the feasibility of turning it back into a lab. So they have funding at the moment to convert one of the caverns which used to house a solar neutrino experiment. It was actually Ray Davis's experiment, which won him the Nobel Prize. So they've drained the mine down to that level and are starting to refurbish that cavity to take another dark matter detector. But they basically have plans. So these are billion-dollar plans to excavate very large cavities here and use it as a long baseline neutrino oscillation project. So that's the world status. So if we come closer to home and we look at SNOWLAB. So SNOWLAB was set up with a set of objectives to promote an international program of astroparticle physics, basically exploiting the success of the SNOW detector. It provides a deep lab to shield the experiments from the cosmic rays. One of the unique features of SNOWLAB is it's operated as a clean laboratory. So in many of the other underground labs, it's up to the experiment to build a sufficiently clean area. The philosophy at SNOWLAB is that we wanted to control access to the lab just at one or two points, make sure everything that came through there was clean to the point that it needs to be, and then you know you're not going to cross-contaminate other experiments. So you know once you get something into the lab, it's been cleaned and it will stay clean. So the entire lab is operated at class 2000 or better, depending on the science requirements, to get rid of the background radiation. to provide infrastructure and support to the experiment. So at the moment, we have a focus on dark matter, double beta decay, and solar and neutrino experiments, which require this depth and cleanliness. The overall status at the moment is the surface facility has been operational from 2005. That provides everything you'd expect to see in a surface lab, including clean rooms where you can build components of the detector before you take it underground. The underground construction, the excavation was completed in June 2007, and we're now, by spring 2011, we'll be at the point where the whole laboratory is at class 2000 or better. The experimental program for SNOWLAB, we're continuing operation of a couple of dark matter detectors that have been squeezed into other areas of the SNOW experiment. They've now been relocated into the new facility. We also have our first completely non-Canadian project, KU, that's come up from Chicago. That's been installed and is now operating a 4-kilogram chamber. There's a suite of other programs, primarily on dark matter and neutrino studies, as I say, that I'll give more details on in a bit. The operational funding is currently secured to 2013, and quite recently there was an announcement of a program for support for major science infrastructures that we would be eligible to bid to. So that's a very positive development in the last couple of weeks. So these are the surface facilities. So this is the original SNOW buildings are here. SNOW, for those who aren't aware, used $300 million worth of the Canadian heavy water strategic supply. So there's a lot of security involved in this blue building to make sure that the water was secure. This building was built as part of the SNOWLAB operations, and it, as I say, it has everything you'd expect to see, including clean rooms and offices throughout the facility. Underground, the SNOW detector existed here in the SNOW cavern, and the original SNOW operation was around these three stubs here in that cavity. So the clean boundary was placed here. Since that time, the clean boundary has now been pushed back to this point, and all of these areas have been excavated. And these are the areas that are now going clean. I'll refer to areas known as the cube hall, the cryopit, and the ladder labs. These are the primary areas that we're putting experiments in. So to give you an idea, this the SNOW cavern, it's the largest excavation at this depth anywhere in the world. The cryopit is the third largest, and the cube hall is the second largest excavation. And that gives you the sort of scale that we're talking about. So in terms of surface area, we're going up from something like 750 square meters within the original SNOW phase to something usable space of the order of 3,000 square meters, so a significant expansion. So hopefully these will show well. This is just a tour through the facility. So we have a megawatt of cooling. Clearly, I didn't mention that we're hosted in the Valet mine in Crichton. It's a working nickel mine, so we have to make sure that we dovetail into the operations of the company. One of the areas that we're very aware of is that we will be building experiments that will use, for instance, tons of liquid argon, potentially many tons of liquid argon. And so if we had all of that boil off, we need to make sure that we can control the flow of that gas without putting it into the mining area and asphyxiating miners. So this is the part of the air handling system here. Behind there is the ventilation shaft, which basically bypasses the mine and gets dumped into the mine, the main mine air rays. There's chilling involved here, so there's water cooling that goes to all the air handling units inside the facility to maintain the temperature at a reasonable 20, 22 sort of temperature. The rock temperature at this depth is 41 C. And then part of the structure at the back is for filtration, so that the we clearly need to filter the air that goes into the facility to make sure we're not bringing in any contamination. And it's a working mine, so you can imagine that when they're blasting, there are occasionally quite a lot of dust particles that come through. So that's an integral part. We have to change those filters basically every day. That's a close-up of the chiller. So we have 5 units totaling a megawatt. We're using currently 1.5, so there's plenty of room for expansion for putting more experiments in. So this is the main access point to the lab. So there's a boot wash station. So you walk to the lab, you clean your boots, and you go through the personnel door. The doors on the side are for the going into the experiment or the equipment wash area, so that when you take equipment through, it goes through a double cleaning. The red area, the red paint on the floor indicates that it's not quite so clean area. So you bring material in, clean it in that area, bring it through into this area, clean it again, and then you bring it into the lab. So we have a team of dedicated cleaners who basically ensure that the science can get done, because we're not bringing in any contamination into the detector systems. To give you an indication, the snow experiment, if you'd piled enough mine dust onto a loony, or piled mine dust onto a loony and thrown that into the snow detector, you would have destroyed the science. The background would have been then sufficiently high that you wouldn't have been able to see the neutrino signal. People get washed as well, so everybody goes down, has to go through a shower. Again, this is to get rid of mine dust, obviously, in your hair as you walk down, things like that. So you've got to make sure that you're extremely clean going in. Everybody then gets into clean room garb. Ah, I shouldn't have said that. This was before we went clean, so they're not in clean room garb. If anybody went down to snow, this just was to illustrate that this was in the mine. So this is part of the lab entry going down to snow, which is down around that corner. So this was in the mine, so a lot of effort had to go into cleaning all of the cabling and pipework to make sure that it was of the required standard, so that we could maintain the cleanliness in snow lab. Every surface basically inside the laboratory has been touched by hand. That's why it's a laborious process. Every cable is taken out and cleaned. Once we've done that, of course, when we're bringing new stuff in, it's easy, because you can just control the cleanliness of the stuff coming in. This shows Tony Noble, the previous director of Snow Lab, ubiquitous Tim Hortons. Never heard of Tim Hortons before I came here. Made the mistake of asking for a cappuccino in Tim Hortons once. yes, anyhow. So Tony, this is the Galen Refuge. The refuge is capable of taking up to 100 people. And in the event of an emergency underground, the idea would be that everybody piles into the refuge. You shut the door. It's hermetically sealed. You stay there until somebody comes to rescue you. And the benefit of refuges has obviously been proven in the Chilean incident quite recently. At the back, so again, this just shows you the shot in the refuge. One thing I wanted to say is the walls here are very smooth, and that was a deliberate change from snow. So the last layer of shotcrete was troweled down and then painted, and that gives you a very smooth surface. Again, it's all designed to ensure the cleanliness. At the back of the galley, we have a small meeting room. This is the world's deepest astrophysics lecture going on. Obviously talking about dark matter, I suspect, with that. And then we're currently converting this area into the clean area. So this was before the final concrete pad had been put down. But you can see here, this is the concrete, the shotcrete walls before it gets troweled down, so it's quite lumpy, and that houses some of the dust. So this is now being converted into a clean room area. And if you look at the cryopit from the top, it still looks something like this. We've removed the ladderway now that we're going in clean here. So everybody's now working on converting this, painting this, making it into a clean area. That's looking down, that's looking up. So the idea of the cryopit is we actually have expansion capability at Snow Lab. This is not allocated yet, and the intent would be that this would be able to take a large dark matter or double beta decay detector where you basically put it into a tank of water. And, okay, the cube hall, this is the staircase leading into the cube hall. There's no one there. Let me give you some scale. This is scale, so that's a person showing the sort of scale that we have here. This is just before it went fine cleaning, but it's now been painted and so on, so it's relatively clean. And when it's been fine cleaned and some of the infrastructure for two new experiments put in, this is what it looks like from the top. So this is for two dark matter detectors. Deep 3600 will fit here. Mini clean will fit here, but this shows you it's a ship in a bottle approach. So everything that you do has to come down that cage and be constructed underground. And that's when we finally took the cube hall clean, so we're now in clean room garb. The ladder labs, the final area. This is me opening up the ladder labs. This was last year when we converted that to a final clean area. And that shows you the ladder labs and the way they look at the moment. Again, very clean area. So, for time's sake, let me skip that. So the situation at the moment is that we're basically almost done here. So all the contractors are out. We're now using Snow Lab personnel to finish off. And we're at the point where we're taking in experiments. So the experimental program at Snow Lab looks like this. There's a suite of experiments, and it's broken down by the science that we're looking at. So you see we have a very heavy focus at the moment on the dark matter program, and the neutrinos takes up most of the other work. And these experiments will be slotted into the lab, something like this. So Snow is being converted to Snow Plus. We have Picasso and Deep have recently been relocated from here up into the Picasso in this area, Deep up here. Picasso, Ku, Darkside, Super CDMS, Deep 3600 and Mini Clean are all dark matter detectors of varying types, and Halo is a supernova detector. Okay, so that's the facility. So I'll just finish off by showing you the science program that we have at Snow Lab. So I've mentioned the dark matter problem. We have three different technologies being deployed, one using liquid nobles, one using superheated liquids or bubble chambers, and one using solid-state detectors. So the majority of the noble liquids use liquid argon, although MiniClean will be able to use liquid neon as well. And we've had a prototype running in Snow Lab for Deep. The construction for Deep 3600 and MiniClean is underway, and that is now funded. So they're focused primarily on spin-independent work. The superheated liquid or bubble chamber, the Picasso and Ku technologies. Picasso is operational in Snow Lab. It's recently been relocated. Ku 4 kilogram is completed, and we expect their 60 kilogram version to appear early next year. And then Super CDMS. CDMS is the currently leading dark matter project around the world. That'll be underground probably in 2 years' time. This is their plan. The problem they have at the moment is that they're at Sudan, which is only 4,000 meters water equivalent, which is not deep enough. So we're tempting them south, telling them that we can go deeper. They're currently in Minnesota. So the idea would be that this would be a large-scale detector coming down, probably in about 2 to 3 years. The Deep 3600 MiniClean detectors have very similar detector philosophies. So these are single-phase argon in terms of Deep 3600 or argon neon for MiniClean. So you're looking at the scintillation light as the dark matter particle hits it, and you get rid of all the other backgrounds, and you can tell the difference. So this is what the final construction will look like. So the frame that you saw in the previous photograph is in place. That's that blue structure there. and looking down onto the frame, this is Marc Boulay, the PI for Deep 3600, standing where his detector will be. And that's the two of us being impressed. To show things are actually happening, this is the MiniClean outer vessel. So this is the vacuum vessel. This is a US project primarily, but that is also being deployed at Snow Lab and will soon be on its way. So Picasso uses a superheated droplet. It's C4F10. The idea there is that you have droplets of C4F10 in a matrix, which is a gel. You basically keep it at a certain temperature and pressure so the droplets are superheated. When the dark matter particle hits it, it explodes, and you listen for that explosion. And this just shows you the change when you get a recoil. So that could be a neutron or a WIMP in your gel, and then you pick that up with a piezoelectric. So this shows one of their detector systems, and that is now installed in Picasso 3 in the Ladder Lab. So this is their new shielding configuration using water boxes. The Ku detector, a bubble chamber detector, uses CF3I. This is now installed in Snow Lab and operational. So you can just about pick out here. This is actually a vessel of CF3I in which you can pick out three bubbles. So that's a neutron multiply scattering in your target volume. And what you look for in this detector is basically single scatters. You know, a WIMP's not going to multiply scatter. And then the rest of it is just shielding around there, again, to get rid of the background. Okay, I've focused on dark matter, but there is also, as I mentioned, a lot of work going on in the neutrino world. And one of the core projects we're looking at there is Snow Plus, and that's a double beta decay detector. This is neutrino-less double beta decay. So two neutrino double beta decays expected in the standard model, but with a long half-life. Neutrino-less is generally forbidden in the standard model, but there are beyond the standard models where you can get this effect occurring, and basically what you get is two electrons coming off with the sum energy of the decay, and no neutrinos coming out. So you're looking for that sort of event. We have two detectors that we're working on. Snow Plus, I mentioned. Snow Plus, we're using the existing snow detector, but we replace the heavy water with liquid scintillator. That we then dope it with neodymium. And neodymium is a double beta decay emitter, and you're looking for that transition. The problem is that liquid scintillator is much lighter than heavy water, so all of the engineering for snow is completely wrong because the acrylic vessel was suspended because it was heavier than the water shield around it. So having to reconfigure it and basically put a rope net on top of the acrylic vessel to hold the detector down. Capital funding for this is just about to turn on. The second detector that we have is EXO, where they're looking at the transition in xenon 136 to barium, and there's some R&D work going on for EXO on surface. So this is the Snow Plus detector. So this shows you inside the acrylic vessel. You can't quite make it out, but there are ropes here on the outside of the acrylic vessel. You're looking through the acrylic vessel to the photomultipliers. There's about 2 meters between the acrylic vessel and the PMTs. You're looking through to the photomultiplier array. They're the ropes, which we have to then convert to hold down ropes. So we're in the process of doing a lot of the engineering at the moment to do that conversion, including things like just measuring the acrylic vessel. This is now getting on a bit. It's well outside its expected lifetime because we're extending it from the snow detector. But it's still very spherical to within a couple of millimeters, which is tremendous. Again, that's just doing a survey of the acrylic vessel. One of the changes we are needing to do is, I've dropped a word off there, is for the new process system for the scintillator, the plant is actually much larger than used for the heavy water. So this is happening inside our clean room. So this is an additional challenge, is how do you do real mining inside a clean room to get the areas and retain it. And then the final neutrino area is we have a dedicated supernova watch experiment called HALO, where they're looking at the interactions of the neutrinos in lead, both the charge and neutral current interactions. This is an effective reuse of material. So the lead There's 80 tons of lead in this stack shown here. This comes from an experiment at Chalk River. The neutron detectors, the NCDs, are being reused from the SNOW experiment. So this is currently being installed, and we expect it to be operational by the end of this year. So that's a bit of a whirlwind trip around the program. But the conclusion I want to leave you with is that, you know, we're in the final phase of going clean at SNOW Lab. We've been using the surface building for a while. All the major infrastructure is in place, and we're now making the transition to the experimental program. So we have deployment of some of the support systems for the first experiments, smaller scale experiments been ongoing, with a strong focus on dark matter, which was the initial justification I gave you about going deep, and the neutrino programs. So in total conclusion, SNOW Lab is looking forward to contributing to the world of underground science. Thank you.